You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And I'd like to welcome you to this session. We will explore the connections between disasters and displacement, looking at some of the challenges and solutions of working on them. Some 150 million people were displaced by natural disasters, sudden onset natural disasters over the past 5 years. It's a huge issue and one that deserves more attention. We have a very distinguished panel that's going to be telling you everything you need to know about disasters and displacement over the course of the next hour or so. And we're going to begin with Ambassador Claude Ville, who is the head of human security in the Federal Department of Foreign Affairs of Switzerland. He has a long and distinguished history working in peacekeeping operations in Namibia and Western Sahara, and has been a diplomat with the Swiss government since 1992 with postings in Moscow, Brussels, Ottawa, Lagos, Vienna, and now you're back in Bern doing this important work. He'll begin with some opening remarks on the issue of displacement and disasters. We'll then turn to my co-director of the Brookings LSE Project on Internal Displacement, Chaloka Bayani, who is a professor of international law at London School of Economics. He, too, has worked on these issues for many, many years and was instrumental in drafting the world's first binding regional instrument on internal displacement, the AU Convention on IDPs, sometimes known as the Kampala Convention. It's great to have you here in Washington with us, Chaloka, and look forward to
hearing
you.
Pleased to be here. Thank you, Beth.
And as you might imagine, Chaloka is going to focus on displacement within the borders of a country that are caused by disasters. We're then going to turn to my former co-director, Walter Kaelin, who was a representative of the Secretary General on the Human Rights of IDPs until 2010. He's a professor of international law at the University of Bern, and now is going to be speaking to us about the Nansen Initiative, where he's the envoy of the chairmanship, which looks particularly at cross-border disaster-induced displacement. So we'll start by looking at internal displacement.
Are your mics on?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
No.
No, okay. Well, somebody's going to check and make sure this. I'll try to speak just a little bit more directly into this microphone. So Chaloka is going to talk mainly about internal displacement caused by disasters. Then we're going to turn to Walter Kaelin, who's going to focus on cross-border displacement caused by disasters. And then to round things off, we're delighted to have Jane McAdam with us, who's an expert on climate change and displacement. She's written several books on the legal framework and gaps around the issue of displacement. She also teaches international law at the University of New South Wales in Sydney and is director of the new Calder Center for International Refugee Law. And we're delighted to have you, Jane, and Walter, and Chaloka, and I think it should be a great discussion. Please, if you can't hear any of the speakers, give us a little wave, and we'll have everybody talk into their microphones. Please, Claude.
Thank you very much. Is that working?
That's great.
Yeah. Okay. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear panelists, dear Beth, as every year, on the occasion of the Swiss Day, it's a great pleasure for me to be here to brainstorm a little bit with eminent panelists and with the U.S. public about the global challenge in the humanitarian field. And at this year's event, we would like to draw your attention to a growing challenge worldwide on which Switzerland has decided to act. This challenge is the one of displacement in the context of disaster. So let us a little bit analyze this phenomenon of displacement more in details. I'm giving here the introductory remarks, and then we will have the specialists delving into the subject. Over the year, if we look, the factors driving displacements have changed. In the past, displacement was usually mainly related to armed conflict and the ensuing human rights violations. As the numbers show, conflict is still an important driver of displacement. According to the International Displacement Monitor Center, IDMC, 29 million people were displaced by conflict in 2012. However, another driver has gained in importance in recent years, displacement by disaster, which currently outnumbers conflict-related displacement. According to IDMC, over 144 million people were displaced by sudden onset disaster in more than 120 countries in the 5 years between 2008 and 2009. This number is far bigger than the numbers of refugees and IDPs displaced by persecutions and armed conflict, and is likely to increase in the context of global warming. If we were also to count the persons displaced by the so-called slow onset disaster, like drought, the numbers would be exponential, would be much, much higher. So this is worth to have in mind. Displacement, in particular internal displacement, has been an issue of crucial interest to Switzerland for nearly now a decade. Internally displacement persons represent a particularly vulnerable category of civilians who suffer the consequences of conflict and whom governments have an obligation to assist and protect. For Swiss foreign policy, the protection of the human rights of internally displaced persons is therefore a priority. We highlight this priority in the Swiss strategy for protection of civilians in armed conflict. I've put some exemplary of this strategy outside. You are welcome to pick them up. In this strategy, we focus on the protection of the most vulnerable groups, children, women, IDPs. To implement the IDP part, protection part of this strategy, we started to support the work of the Special Representative on Human Rights of IDPs in 2005 and continue closely to cooperate with the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of IDP, Chaloka Beyani, because we want a result-oriented foreign policy. And the mandate holder, Chaloka, needs to be empowered. That's the philosophy why we work, academic, diplomacy, UN. It's a nice cluster, and it's the philosophy of a bit Swiss foreign policy that is influenced by watchmaking. We want to see a result, not just a nice concept. But we need the academia to give us the right lead on where we should head for results. All right, as I said, the strategy you have noticed is for protection of civilians in armed conflict. But specifically, as I said in the beginning, we have displaced persons that are displaced outside of armed conflict. And they too need an instrument of protection. So with respect to the internal displacement, in the context of disaster, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights of IDPs has an important role to play, and the topic is very rightfully among Chaloka Beyani's thematic priorities. While the need of persons displaced within their own country following a disaster are covered by the operational guidelines on the protections of persons in situation of natural disasters, the rights of those fleeing abroad, that is what is important, fleeing abroad in another country under such conditions are not protected. We are particularly concerned with this group, which does not fit into either of the classic categories of refugees or IDPs. Yet the understanding of the dynamics of displacement and disaster, respectively, and how these two phenomena are interrelated is still quite poor. Therefore, consolidated findings about displacement in the context of disaster and climate change are urgently needed. Furthermore, adequate tools and guidance need to be developed so that states are better equipped to protect the rights of people displaced by disaster. So we have here identified a gap in Swiss humanitarian policy, where world governance had no response. So there was a clear need for an initiative to create a protection agenda for people displaced out of their own country by disasters. Now, maybe, how did it start? We identified the gap, and the response of a responsible diplomacy is to try to fill the gap with an initiative that can be mainstream, yield an agenda that, at the end, is implemented. So that's the journey we are on. We seized the occasion of the UNHCR ministerial conference to commemorate the Refugee and Statelessness Convention in December 2011. We seized this occasion together with Norway to make the following pledge, and I quote, to cooperate with interested states, UNHCR, and other relevant actors with the aim of obtaining a better understanding of such cross-border movement at relevant regional and sub-regional levels, identifying best practices and developing a consensus on how best to assist and protect the affected people. That's the pledge we made in 2011. And to implement our pledge, we launched the so-called Nansen Initiative. So Nansen, Mr. Nansen, is a very famous Norwegian explorer. He was also the first commissioner for refugees. That's why it is called the Nansen Initiative. And since the special envoy is Professor Kurt Kellin, who is a Swiss national, the name of the initiative had to be Norwegian, since it is a bilateral initiative. What are the characteristics of this initiative? It is a state-led consultative process which aims at building consensus on the elements of a protection agenda that will address the needs of people displaced across international borders in the context of disasters. The Nansen Initiative is led by a steering group composed of seven states from the global north and south: Australia, Bangladesh, Costa Rica, Germany, Mexico, Kenya, and the Philippines. We have the five inhabited continent represented, and the initiative, of course, is co-chaired by Norway and Switzerland. To accommodate other interested states, a group of friends has been created, and I'm very happy to tell you, for those who don't know it, that the U.S. is a member of this group of friends. The process is as well supported by a consultative committee composed of representatives from international organizations, researchers, think tanks, and NGOs. Both Jane McAdam and Bess Ferris are part of this committee. Again, the idea of cluster, so that diplomacy doesn't work alone, or often it doesn't yield the optimum. We have to work in cluster with the real world and also the academic world. So how does it work? At the core of the Nansen Initiative are five regional consultations which aim to gather information about the specific regional situations with regard to displacement in the context of disasters. So far, two of these consultations have taken place successfully, one in the South Pacific and another in Central America. The third one is due for May in the region of the Horn of Africa. It will be in Nairobi. But Professor Kelling will delve into the details. Now, to conclude, maybe the protection agenda that will come out of all these regional consultations will be hopefully set up at a global meeting in summer 2015, so it will be soon. And once we have consensus on the key element of this protection agenda for this cross-border disaster-induced displaced person, we will start then it's another battle that starts, to shape the international discussion around this agenda. And until we reach that stage, there are still several challenges. I will just briefly mention them. As the consultations so far revealed, the realities regarding displacement in the context of disaster differ, of course, substantially in different regions of the world. So we will have to answer following questions on the way ahead. How can the protection agenda address specific regional needs but still be of value at the international level? This requires a creative approach with regard to the design and content of the follow-up. Second challenge, how should then this product be best promoted and disseminated to assure it is widely known? And which implementation mechanism will ensure that effective links are established with thematically related processes? I will stop here with these questions that show the ways that we still have to cover to make sure that our initiative does not only create a new protection agenda on paper, but that this protection agenda is then efficiently implemented on the ground so that effective protection can be delivered to this very vulnerable group of disaster-induced cross-border displaced person. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Claude. We'll turn now to Chiloka Bayani to hear about internal displacement caused by disasters.
Thank you, Beth. I hope that my microphone is catching and projecting my voice. Ambassador Claude, distinguished delegates, and my also distinguished fellow panelists, it gives me great pleasure to be at Brookings in my capacity as co-director of the Brookings LSC project on internal displacement. And I think it's also a matter of particular pleasure that I share the panel with very distinguished panelists, no less than my predecessor, Walter Kalin, whose tenureship of the mandate I try to emulate most of the time, Jen McAdam, who has done some cutting-edge work on climate change-induced displacement. So I believe that I'm actually in very good company as a result of that. But let me start by indicating the magnitude of the problem. And of course, the figures may vary depending on who is doing the counting. And my figures are very much based on partly the report that I did to the UN on climate change in 2011. But according to UN estimates, up to 50 million people are estimated to be internally displaced due to natural disasters each year. And the impact of the natural on the human often is exacerbated by humanity's unmitigated interaction with nature. And the consequences of this are a worldwide phenomenon that knows of no geographical boundaries. We're used to dealing with conflict-induced displacement, which by and large we see and perceive as a phenomenon of the global south. But in responding to disaster-related displacement, clearly the north and all parts of the world are not exempt. And I do remember that when Walter Kalin looked at the victims of Katrina and called them IDPs, there was quite some consternation in this part of the world because IDPs very often are found elsewhere, not in the United States or Canada or the United Kingdom for that matter. But that is the reality that we actually face. And imagine the following scenarios, which have just taken place between December 2013 to February 2014. The southwestern part of the UK is completely flooded. Areas in Dorset are cut off as rural networks are washed away by floods and rising sea levels. Farmers are unable to till their land for some time. They're only compensated by the government £5,000 each, which is obviously inadequate. So food insecurity looms because the farmers say for quite some time our lands will remain unproductive, perhaps for the next one or even 2 years. And then last week, sandstorms from the Sahara Desert, no less, were carried all the way into the UK, causing smog and pollution. The sick, especially those with asthma, were warned to stay indoors. And cars were covered in sand, and people were surprised when they woke up each morning to actually find sand and soot on their cars and asking, why is this? And the weather persons did say, this is sand that has been carried all the way from the Sahara Desert into the UK. Prime Minister David Cameron cancels his morning run due to pollution and sand particles in the air, a measure of personal adaptation, no less. But obviously this indicates that the impacts know no geographical boundaries at all, and we are all at risk. And in Washington State here, a mudslide kills more than 20 persons, something that we haven't experienced before. We have heard of mudslides in Uganda, in Asia, and elsewhere. But the impact of climate change and natural disasters is actually real and very much close to us than we do imagine. So these and other events show that our perception of the gravity of the impact of natural disasters should therefore be recast with global measures and global outlooks on precaution, taking into account causal links between the pattern and frequency of natural disasters and climate change as drivers of potential actual displacement in different parts of the world. Although I refer to climate change, I will not get into the substance of that because that is Jen's area of expertise. But it is also significant that in 2010 alone, 42.3 million people were newly displaced by sudden onset natural disasters, 90% of which were due to climate-related effects, and 14.9 million were displaced in 2011 by sudden onset disasters. In recent years, the impact of such disasters has been felt in countries such as Australia, Bangladesh, China, Haiti, India, Japan, Pakistan, the Philippines, New Zealand, Uganda, UK, and the US. Slow onset disasters have also been evident, for example, in the Horn of Africa, in the Sahel region, and also in Afghanistan. Low island states such as the Maldives, Tuvalu, Nauru have borne the brunt of rising sea levels and face the risk of submersion. It is estimated that by 2100, sea levels will have risen by 1 meter and likely to cause disproportionate effects in different parts of the world. What then are the adverse impacts of natural disasters? I think even if we refer to these as natural disasters, it is always worth recalling, and I think the point is repeatedly made, that natural events or occurrences may have a life of their own. What makes them a disaster is their impact on humanity, which in turn owes much to the adverse effect of humanity's own activities or interaction with the environment. Lack of better planning. We like to have better views of the sea, so we build our houses on mountain slopes. And when earthquakes, which are natural, occur, then of course that becomes a disaster. There's a clash between natural events and occurrences and nature. But the following, obviously, are the more adverse impacts that have been tabulated. Increased droughts or rainfall, as the case may be, environmental degradation, and slow onset disasters such as famine or desertification, which undermine agricultural livelihoods and reduce food security, intensify competition of access to water and natural resources, and therefore may cause people to move. Contraction of snow-covered areas and melting of sea ice, leading, amongst other things, to rising sea levels and high water temperatures, affecting the habitability of coastal areas and low-lying island states. Increased frequency and intensity of weather-related natural hazards, such as tropical cyclones, hurricanes, mudslides, and flooding, which will threaten the physical safety of affected populations and leads to potential actual planned relocation of persons from high-risk areas. Conflict and social upheaval, directly or indirectly attributable to climate change-related factors, such as competition for natural resources, changing livelihood patterns, increased social tensions, and possible concentration of vulnerable population, including nomads, pastoralists, and those in informal settings in poor urban areas, where the mega trend, owing to slow onset disasters, is rural urban migration and the consequence that those who migrate live in precarious areas within the informal settlements. So within the broader context of the impact of the effects of disasters on humanity and human rights, affected populations who have been forced to leave their home or place of habitual residence are a category of persons considered to be especially at risk within states or across international borders, as the case may be. And indeed, as the guiding principles do tell us, those displaced within states fall in the category of internally displaced persons. According to the guiding principles, persons or groups of persons who have been forced or obliged to flee or to leave their homes or places of habitual residence, in particular as a result of or in order to avoid, in this context, the effects of natural or human-made disasters, and who have not crossed an internationally recognized state border. So it's quite clear that the regime related to IDPs of a period of time was forward-looking in including within the definition of IDPs those who may be coerced to move as a result of natural or human-made disasters as a result. But as my mandate has repeatedly emphasized, it's very important to underscore the need for a human rights-based approach to natural disasters and the protection of persons affected. And natural disasters pose a risk to the right to life, have negative implications for such basic rights as the right to adequate food and housing, water and health, and affect the overall right to an adequate standard of living. Some of my colleagues in the special procedures are special rapporteurs on the right to food, housing, for example, have documented the effects of climate change and disasters on the impact of such rights. But we have seen progress in the application of a human rights-based approach to situations of natural disasters. In 2010, under Walter Kellin's tenureship of the mandate, the Interagency Standing Committee adopted the revised operational guidelines on the protection of persons in situations of natural disasters. These guidelines provide a tool for identifying and responding to particular human rights protection challenges in situations of natural disasters and provide guidance on practical measures that can be taken during all phases of disaster response to mitigate or to prevent such challenges. And I'll get back to this theme later. But in my view, a human rights-based approach also calls for a synthesis between human rights and international environmental law as regards precaution, intergenerational equity, and causation. Human rights should be seen to provide a basis for organizing these standards in the context of the right to a safe environment. That means state responsibility for protecting human rights is premised on the foreseeability of risk or harm, which implicates disaster risk reduction and preparedness with regard to adverse impacts of natural disasters, whether slow onset or sudden onset. In other words, which areas of the states are foreseeably at risk in future to the impact of natural disasters, whether a sudden onset or slow onset. And if such foreseeability clearly is indicated, then measures of preparedness and disaster risk reduction then should also kick in. And the failure to do so, including to warn persons of the likelihood of the recurrence of disasters in human rights, has found states to be responsible for that failure. So this is an important development within human rights. Holding a place within the human rights framework for IDPs are, of course, the 1998 guiding principles that I've already mentioned, the ES guidelines on natural disasters, but added to this is also the interagency framework for durable solutions that I will come to towards the end of my discussion. And the operationalization of this framework is central to the current priority of my mandate on durable solutions. The global regime has been complemented by certain regional developments, notably the African Union Convention on the Protection and Assistance of Internally Displaced Persons, or the Kampala Convention, which specifically requires that measures be taken to protect and assist IDPs who have been displaced due to natural or human-made disasters, including climate change. It's a particular objective of the convention to prevent, mitigate, prohibit, and eliminate the root causes of internal displacement. And this requirement of prevention and mitigation within the convention is further detailed in the obligation to devise early warning systems in areas of potential development, displacement, and develop disaster risk reduction strategies and emergency preparedness, as well as management measures, in addition to providing protection and assistance if necessary. I think it's also important to notice that preparedness will require investments in technologies. It will also require preparedness as regards sustainability of livelihoods. It will also require preparedness in the context of evacuation, as justified by the guiding principles in terms of the safety and health of individuals involved, and also should not amount to arbitrary displacement, as the guiding principles tell us. I would now like to look at the whole issue of durable solutions in the context of natural disasters and what might be useful in the context of beyond displacement and the need for durable solutions. A number of factors are conducive to durable solutions. One such factor is ensuring a transition early on from the humanitarian assistance phase to early recovery and reconstruction, thus allowing IDPs either to return to their places of origin and rebuild their lives as early as possible after disaster, or to be locally integrated elsewhere, or indeed be resettled elsewhere according to the circumstances. But needless to say that the issue of choice must be informed, and the participation of IDPs, of course, as the practice has shown, must be taken into account. Similarly, promoting self-reliance of affected communities and re-establishing local economies and livelihoods, such as by increasing access to credit via financial services for the poor in the form of microfinance, utilizing existing markets in their different facets and forms of livelihoods, can help facilitate durable solutions. Actively promoting the participation of affected communities in all the activities, from humanitarian assistance delivery activities to engagement with development actors, also encourages early recovery, ensures that projects use and reflect the capacities of IDPs as well as their needs. It's also important to look at the role of receiving communities, their participation in these processes, where that is possible. Achieving durable solutions for IDPs due to natural disasters should be part of contingency plans at local, national levels, involving capacity building programs for disaster preparedness, evacuation, protection, assistance, and also resilience building, supported by national budgetary provision, as well as development processes. Some effects of natural disasters may affect what types of durable solutions are accessible to affected populations. In the case of certain types of sudden or slow onset disasters, for example, return may no longer be possible in the foreseeable future. Increasingly, too, it is acknowledged that durable solutions are not necessarily one-dimensional or static, but may, in fact, be a combination of solutions, which include perhaps seasonal or temporary or split solutions, as the case may be. It could be that one part of the family resides somewhere temporarily, another part of the family could be elsewhere, and these are transitional solutions that, in the end, should lead to durable solutions based on the fact that the decision with regard to durable solutions must be based on free and informed consent. However, new approaches may have to be made possible through regional and international cooperative efforts, which may pave the way for new standards and options, including cross-border displacements. And the NASAN initiative is a significant development in that respect, and my mandate stands ready to reinforce forces with the NASAN initiative in looking at this issue. And I think this is the appropriate point at which I should hand over to Jen to look at to look at water and the NASAN initiative and what it is doing. Sorry, I got confused. Yeah.
Thank you, Chiloka. We'll turn to Walter then to look at cross-border displacement.
Thank you, Bess. Ladies and gentlemen, it's with some emotions that I'm sitting here. It feels like a class reunion during my time as representative of the Secretary General on the human rights of internally displaced persons. I really depended on the support by the Brookings project on internal displacement, and was always happy to come here and sit also here on this podium. Now I'm back with a different hat on, as you have heard, envoy of the chairmanship of the Nansen Initiative, the chairmanship being Switzerland and Norway. What are we talking about? Some months ago, many of the media in many countries had headlines such as the world's first climate refugee not granted asylum. This referred to a case litigated in New Zealand at the level of the Immigration Tribunal and then the High Court, of a man from Kiribati, one of the most vulnerable low-lying islands in the Pacific, who had come to ask for asylum in New Zealand, saying that he and his family had been living on the main island, the capital, had lost the house where they had been living, that they were unable to return to the island where they originally had come from because the island was no longer inhabitable as consequences of climate change. The judge accepted that this man was in a very difficult situation, but came to the conclusion, sorry, our national laws, exactly as international law, does not provide protection for people like you. This was one person. January 2010, the earthquake in Haiti, displacing large numbers of people internally. This is a well-known story, an often told story. What is less known is that already during the first night, families showed up with wounded family members at the border to the Dominican Republic. They knew exactly that there was no medical help available at that time, immediately after the disaster in Haiti. In the middle of the night, the president was woken up and asked, are we going to open the borders or do we keep them closed? He couldn't get any guidance from any international standards. It was probably his heart that felt, I have to let these people in because they are in a very difficult, life-threatening situation. But Haitians till today show up in Central America, beyond that, Brazil. Haitians are still in temporary protection status in this country. And the question again is, how should states react to the needs of these people? Do they deserve protection? Do they need protection? And is there any obligation to grant? In the Haitian context, we're talking about some 10,000 of people that crossed borders, were arguably displaced across international borders. 2010-2011, in the Horn of Africa, the peak of a 10-year period of drought in Somalia. Pastoralists lose their last animals, crops are destroyed, and people show up at the borders of Kenya in the 100,000s, about 150,000, at the borders of Ethiopia, of Djibouti. And again, the question is, what to do with these people? Governments were very generous and granted them refugee status. But these were people who said, we are not really fleeing the conflict. We haven't been attacked. We haven't been targeted by whoever is fighting in this conflict. It's because we will die unless you let us in. These are some examples. And as you can show, it can be at an individual level of a few individuals, a family. It can be large communities. It can be really whole countries that are affected by disasters caused by natural hazards. These disasters can be sudden onset, like windstorms, earthquakes, tsunamis, flooding. They can be slow onset like drought desertification or rising sea levels with ensuing slow onset deterioration of the environment. People are displaced, we know, also as a consequence of state measures. States have a duty to protect people, and this means, and their lives, and this means that sometimes governments tell people, you can't stay here. This is a disaster-prone area. Move out. But where can they go? Sometimes governments take measures to forcibly relocate people. I've seen that in Southern Africa, in a country where the government said, we simply can't afford every second year after the flooding to rebuild the whole infrastructure, but people didn't want to go. Many, many questions. And as we know, most of the people displaced by natural hazards and ensuing disasters remain within their own country. They fall under Chaloka Bayani's mandate. Some cross borders. We don't know the actual numbers. This is not a recognized category, and if a category does not exist, it's not being counted. So we simply don't have the overall number. But wherever I go to all the regions we went to have the consultations, not one single government told me it's not an issue. Quite to the contrary. They all say it's a real issue. And to address this real issue in a situation where we have all these gaps, and it's not only legal gaps, it's also gaps in terms of the actual response. It's gaps regarding the mandates of the humanitarian agencies. They don't really fall under UNHCR's mandate. Who is responsible? We don't really know. We do have the cluster system and the approach, but for instance, when it comes to the protection cluster, every time there's a big fight, not to have to take over that role of running the protection cluster. And that's just internal. And when people cross borders, again, we don't have to respond. There are funding gaps. Funding gaps are important, particularly when we're looking into the future. When we're looking at climate change, Professor McAdam will take that up. But if we just read what the panel of experts on climate change published last week, it's again quite alarming. And I do not belong to the alarmist school who says we know for sure that in the middle of this century it will be 200 or 500 million. But we know it's increasing. And this is something also the humanitarian agencies knew. Back in 2007, 2008, we at that time had a discussion within the framework of the coordination mechanism of the humanitarian agencies and the big NGO networks, the Interagency Standing Committee, where we felt that those negotiating on climate change would have to be brought into the picture. That traditional funding mechanisms, response capacities by the international community would be insufficient in the long term. We made submissions to the climate change negotiators in Copenhagen, and I think we were quite successful when the climate change negotiations in Cancun 2010 adopted the Cancun Adaptation Framework with a short paragraph among a long list of paragraphs, paragraph 14F, recognizing that displacement, voluntary migration, planned relocation, both internally and cross borders, are one of the really key challenges of adapting to climate change. This was a full recognition by the international community. It's an issue. It was put on the agenda. But the problem was where to take it from there. With all due respect to climate change negotiators, these are not the people who have the role or would be able to give content to such a short paragraph. And it was then when UNHCR took up the issue, not with the success the High Commission for Refugees expected, and when then Switzerland and Norway came in and the initiative was started. Let me tell you a little bit about kind of lessons learned. This initiative is time-bound. We started beginning of last year. We have conducted two regional consultations, as mentioned by Ambassador Wild, in the Pacific, in Central America. We are very close to the third consultation in the Horn of Africa. We already had a civil society pre-meeting. I went to the region, visited several of the countries, talked to governments, academics, civil society. What have we learned that far? What are some of the kind of intermediate outcomes? We'll have two more consultations towards the end of the year, in the Philippines for Southeast Asia, most likely in Bangladesh for South Asia. Middle of next year, we will have a global consultation and we'll adopt what we call a protection agenda, a document bringing all of this together. And then we'll come back to what it's, this protection agenda should be and how it is instrumental in the process we are envisaging. But let me tell a little bit about some of these consultations. Not the Pacific, Jay McAdam will talk about it from the climate change perspective. But let me say a few words about what we discussed in Costa Rica. In Central America, it was very much about sudden onset disasters. Hurricanes, earthquakes, volcano eruptions, and the like. What was felt was that in Central America, states do have quite good developed disaster response, disaster management mechanisms, that they have regional coordination, but that this was kind of addressing the immediate emergency phase, looking at their own people inside their country. What was felt was that cross-border movements of people is a reality. It happens all the time. And very often, governments are generous in providing temporary protection or what they call humanitarian visa. But it's an ad hoc approach. It's not coordinated. And one of the key recommendations is we have to harmonize our approach to temporary protection to humanitarian visas at the regional level. The problem is, if you admit them temporarily, will they go back? They only will go back if they can go back, if there is recovery within a relatively short period of time. This is often not happening. And that's why, second key conclusion, we need to link temporary protection regimes to durable solutions, to recovery activities that are beginning from the beginning, starting very early on. We cannot talk about phases, emergency phase for 3, 6 months, 1 year, and then we slowly move into a development approach of recovery. There was a lot of talk about the situation of migrants, irregular migrants caught up in a disaster. Now, this is a corridor where many people move towards the US borders. And if there is a big disaster, these people are stuck. Laws often do not allow to provide them with humanitarian assistance. They are exposed to any kind of abuses very often, and there are no solutions for them. What are we going to do on that? Again, governments want to talk about that. There will be regional follow-up to all these issues. Horn of Africa. Horn of Africa, there are three big situations. One is still the situation of Somalia, people still staying in camps. There was a lot of discussion about whether refugee law, in particular the African Convention on Refugees, with a very wide, broad notion of refugee, people having to leave their country because of a collapse of public order, whether this was the right approach. The answer, yes, because in our region, displacement in the context of drought is also linked to conflict, to inability to provide humanitarian assistance, food aid to these people inside the country because of a secure environment. We talked a lot, and there will be talk about pastoralists. During centuries, people have been moving with their animals to neighboring areas that are now on the other side of the colonial borders. This has been working quite well. It's a measure of adaptation. There is drought in one part of Kenya, for instance, and they move into Uganda or Ethiopia and vice versa. Problems nowadays are these movements have become more difficult because of, again, conflict-related issues, proliferation of small arms, conflict between the communities that move and the host communities, then a legitimate interest of governments to secure their borders because of threats of terrorism. But the two agendas, opening up space for pastoralist movement so they can escape, can adapt, and the regional security agenda clash. Third element, irregular migrants. Lots of irregular migrants, Ethiopians moving to Ethiopia, etc. And the question of what happens to them. Smuggling, lots of exploitation, enormous protection problems. And many of these people move because of poverty. But in many cases, poverty is caused by drought, by deteriorating environments. I think I have to come to an end if I see you. So let me conclude with 4 points. What have we learned that far? First, these displacements are multi-causal. It's not just a natural hazard. It's many factors. Pre-existing vulnerabilities, lack of resilience, conflict, and so on and so on. And we have to look at it as multi-causal. There's no direct link between climate change and movement of persons. Second, it's very much regional issues. The two examples I gave you, big differences. People remain within their regions in most cases, and responses have to be regional, a big role for regional organizations. Third, we cannot just focus on protection of those already displaced. We need a whole toolbox. Helping people to stay, that's about adaptation, resilience building. Helping people to move voluntarily, to adapt, voluntary migration. Helping people to relocate in a good way, planned, and protection for the displaced. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll turn now to Jane McAdam to talk about climate change and displacement. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Well, distinguished panelists and chair, ladies and gentlemen, may I echo the sentiments expressed by previous speakers and say what a delight it is to be here once again at Brookings, and in particular to have the opportunity to be part of this very eminent panel. It's quite a privilege to be on it. Well, there are certainly a number of overlaps between the issues that Professors Bayani and Kaelin have presented in terms of the relationship between disasters and mobility. But I think climate change is distinct in two ways. The first is that climate change functions as a threat multiplier. So disasters become disasters on steroids. They become more frequent and more intense. Those who are affected are likely to be among the most vulnerable already. So the very poor, those living in environmentally precarious parts of the country, perhaps without the social networks or the capital to get out of harm's way early on. And secondly, climate change is a process. For slow onset impacts, such as sea level rise or salination or desertification, there won't be a sudden event that triggers flight, but rather a gradual deterioration of living conditions that ultimately may render an area uninhabitable. And the classic case that we've heard about is that of the so-called sinking island states, not a term that I like, not a term that the inhabitants of those countries like, places like Tuvalu and Kiribati. As Beth Ferris once said, sudden onset disasters, things like cyclones, hurricanes, and earthquakes, are the easy events to identify. The greater challenge lies in responding to the impact of these slower onset processes, which potentially pose a more permanent risk to the sustainability of certain human settlements over the long term. And the point to note is that current legal frameworks, whether international, regional, or national, generally don't facilitate movement that is anticipatory, where people calculate the future risks and decide that they would rather leave now than stay and wait for the situation to become intolerable. But current protection frameworks like refugee law or complementary protection, that is human rights-based protections, which prevent people from being sent back to persecution or inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment or places where they face arbitrary deprivation of life, are premised on the idea that it's too dangerous to return now. They are far more remedial than they are proactive. And there's a risk that migration in response to slow onset climate change impacts will fade from the international policy agenda because it's considered too hard, raising challenges to the ways in which states have traditionally responded to forced movement. And another thing is that movement in response to slow onset climate change processes is often perceived by governments as a future problem. And when I say governments, I'm thinking probably here of potential receiving states. And so because the longer term impacts of slow onset climate change don't fit domestic political election timescales, it's pretty easy to overlook policy development in that sphere. Of course, the irony of all of this is that if we fail to plan for slow onset displacement, we may eventually end up with disaster situations that necessitate an emergency response. Professor Kalin already spoke about the fact that what we're talking about here is a multi-causal phenomenon. So as with disasters, we can't say that climate change in and of itself will be a sole cause of movement. Studies reveal that people make decisions about whether or not they'll move or stay put based on their overall socioeconomic situation. They'll think about, or rather, the combined changes to the climate and, importantly, their interaction with pre-existing stresses that people may be experiencing, things like general impoverishment, environmental vulnerability, resource scarcity, lack of livelihood opportunities, and so on, will determine if and when people move. So one Bangladeshi government official I interviewed said, he put it like this, he said, imagine that a person can carry 40 kilos on his shoulders. And then on top of that, I come and put another kilo on the top of that load. And now he keels over and dies. What was responsible for that? Was it the 40 kilos that was already there? So all these pre-existing pressures, environmental fragility, resource scarcity, and so on? Or was it that kilo of climate change that I put on the top? And so that's really what we're talking about here. We cannot easily separate out these things. Complex causality arguments are also supported by the science of climate change. So climate scientists will tell you that asking whether or not climate change has caused a particular event is a nonsensical and fundamentally unanswerable question, because no particular short-term event can be conclusively attributed to climate change. Rather, climate represents the average of many weather events over a span of years, and varying averages over time define climate change. Statistical trends point to an increased frequency and severity of extreme weather events, which is consistent with global warming. So while individual events can't be predicted, certainly the likelihood of their occurrence can. So should displacement be addressed then in terms of what drives it, given that I've already looked at why this is quite difficult to determine exactly what's driving it, or should we instead be looking at the needs of people who move and perhaps reconceptualising this issue altogether? So I want to turn now to the scope of existing legal frameworks. Currently, international law only recognises a very small class of people as being in need of protection if they cross an international border. They are refugees, stateless persons, and people eligible for complementary protection, so people fleeing inhuman and degrading treatment and so on. So unless you fall within one of these categories, or you can migrate for lawful reasons based on, having permission to migrate for employment or family reasons or education, then a state will regard you as an illegal immigrant if you attempt to come in. And even though moving in anticipation of future climate change-related events is a perfectly rational response, the existing legal frameworks just don't facilitate this. So very briefly, I'll just explain why refugee law isn't a good fit, and then talk a bit more about the human rights-based protections. So in most cases, international refugee law won't assist someone because there are immense hurdles in showing that climate change impacts amount to persecution, as that is understood in the current case law. Essentially, it's something that is meted out by government or else tolerated by government if the act is being carried out by a non-state actor. And it has to be for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or your membership of a particular social group. And that's very tough to show if you're saying that you're being impacted by the indiscriminate effects of climate change. Complementary protection arising under human rights law might offer some protection, but probably not yet. So, courts have recognised that things like destitution or dire humanitarian conditions can amount to inhuman or degrading treatment, especially cumulatively. So, for instance, if someone from a low-lying island country were facing an increased risk of natural disasters, extreme water shortages, an inability to grow crops, and a heightened risk of illness, could they be protected from return? Well, at some point, yes, but at the moment there are a couple of stumbling blocks. First of all, courts have carefully circumscribed the meaning of inhuman or degrading treatment so that it can't be used simply as a remedy for general poverty except in the most exceptional circumstances. And they've been especially reluctant to find that a person needs protection unless a government deliberately withholds resources from them or actively occasions harm. So it's unlikely that a lack of basic services alone would substantiate a complementary protection claim unless this were to render survival on return impossible. And this is linked to the second point. The timing of the claim really matters. It would seem that for protection to be forthcoming under human rights law, the harm must be relatively imminent. Professor Kalin referred before to the case of the man from Kiribati who sought protection in New Zealand unsuccessfully. And the decision maker said there was no evidence to show that the environmental conditions faced by the man on return to Kiribati would be so parlous that his life would be, and I quote, placed in jeopardy, or that he and his family would not be able to resume their prior subsistence life with dignity. And it was emphasised that the man was unable to show that there was a sufficient risk to his life at the present time. So without considerable jurisprudential development, current mechanisms simply don't offer assistance to people seeking to escape the future impacts of climate change. So what's to be done? Well, clearly, international legal frameworks, particularly those of human rights law, provide us with very important benchmarks. And they are helpfully buttressed by soft law instruments on internal displacement and disasters as well. But they have to be complemented by other strategies from other areas, from migration, sustainable development, urban planning, climate change adaptation, and disaster risk reduction, among others. And those sectors also need to become better integrated so that responses can be effective and holistic. That has to happen both within internal ministries, in national governments, as well as across the board internationally. While there are clearly protection gaps, I think we have to turn our attention to proactive interventions that can be put in place now, rather than just focusing on what we can do if displacement occurs subsequently. First of all, communities that are given the resources for adaptation, including disaster risk reduction and sustainable development practices, may have less need to move permanently if disaster strikes. Similarly, the extent to which relief and rehabilitation is available to those displaced by a sudden onset disaster will affect whether and how quickly they can return home and rebuild. So evidence from last year's Nansen Initiative regional consultation in the Pacific showed that people were very keen to embrace this idea of self-help. They said, we need to and we want to strengthen community resilience, raise awareness, and increase our own preparedness. They wanted to facilitate adaptation so that people could stay in their homes for as long as possible, but they also wanted to develop strategies for people who did want to move. And part of that is developing training and education within their own countries so that people can obtain skills that will be useful if they stay there, but will also be useful if they migrate somewhere else. And in this regard, the Pacific Consultation encouraged states to review their admission and immigration policies and to examine their citizenship laws to ensure that if people did move, dual nationality would be permitted. And in this way, that would help safeguard the cultural identity of those who move on a permanent basis. So planned migration can be a very effective way to build long-term resilience. And as the president of Kiribati has been saying for a long time, merits-based migration or migration with dignity is a policy that he wishes to pursue. Overseas employment provides a livelihood diversification strategy. Remittances can assist back home. And out-migration may actually mean that a smaller population can remain in the country of origin for longer because there are fewer people competing for a small amount of resources. Of course, the extent to which migration can function as a positive form of adaptation will depend on people's socioeconomic status and the extent of assistance available to them. And that's why the legal structures that we put in place will play a key role in determining whether or not migration is a form of adaptation or a sign of a failure to adapt. Well-planned migration can certainly also lessen the likelihood of later humanitarian emergencies and displacement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jane, and thanks to all of our panelists for great interventions. We have time now for questions, and I think we'll take three or four and then give our panelists time to respond. So someone will bring you a microphone, and if you can identify yourself as you speak. And as you're coming, I'll put my question out there first that you can answer if you like it at some point. And that is the linkages between internal displacement and cross-border. Are people displaced internally first, can't find protection, and then cross the border? Does it depend on how far they're living from a border and so on? But please, yes, ma'am. Can you stand up and introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Medita Weiss. I'm here with the United Nations Information Center. Thank you for the very interesting talk. Jane McAdams, you talked about the holistic approach to targeting the different types of groups and the Nansen Initiative. You mentioned a few as well. I was wondering if the panel could address the role of women and how they are disproportionately affected, for example, that they don't have the right to land ownership in many countries. How do you identify these? How do you integrate them in a more holistic model? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take another question or two. Anybody else for the moment? Yes, please. Shiva.
Good afternoon. It was a wonderful presentation, and thank you so much for inviting us. My name is Sudha Rajput from the School of Conflict Analysis and Resolution. I would like to know from the ambassador what is the biggest challenge in as far as protection policy is concerned to respond to disaster related displacement versus those who are displaced because of conflict-induced displacement. Because my research has focused on conflict-induced displacement, and I know that the national governments are less than receptive of outside intervention. So how do you think the national governments are going to respond with the intervention that you are proposing to respond to natural disasters?
Okay, we'll take one more here, Joel.
Joel Charney from Interaction. It seems to me we're in a very minimalist era when it comes to international conventions and international agreements. Your presentations are reminding me that at least a few years ago there was talk of a convention of some kind. It was even drafted a model was even drafted on, displacement resulting, especially refugees resulting from natural disasters. But I get the sense that something like that isn't really tenable. So, Walter, you in particular, I'd be interested as you build toward this, you know, final conference. I mean, what's the global legal framework, if any? Can anything new emerge, or are we just kind of dealing with the way the world is right now?
Thank you. Okay, we have four questions for our panelists. Links between internal and cross-border, the particular role of women in the holistic approach. A specific question for you, Claude, in terms of responding to disaster and related issues. And then the question from Joel about the future of international legal frameworks. Who would like to start? Okay, Walter.
Okay, let me take two of the questions. First, the last one on the chances for any robust legal frameworks. Well, I think there have been these proposals. I mean, there are even written up conventions. The problem is that the issue is very complex, and that those draft conventions kind of barged into an area that was not sufficiently explored. And this has to do with questions of causality. So I haven't seen any convincing definition. And most of these conventions, they link it to causalities. Mm-hmm. People displaced by the effects of climate change, but as Jane explained, this is a non-starter because in a single event, you never can link it to climate change, meaning increased emissions of greenhouse gases, because there always has been flooding and etc. That's one problem. The second problem, it's sensitive in the sense of what we are promoting is, in a way, a product that cannot really be sold, because are we asking governments to open wide their doors at a time when it's difficult even to get admission for refugees that clearly fall under the 1951 Convention? And I think we only can address that issue if we can show it's not just about opening your own doors, but it's about lots of steps and measures that can be taken. I think what will come out, what I hope that should come out of this process is a message. It's a problem that is real, that is potentially huge, but that can be managed. But we need to talk about it. And if it's manageable, then we can avoid many of the negative consequences of just having to react. And I think then the time will come when the situation is ripe to talk about robust legal frameworks. So it's really step by step. That's why we're talking about building consensus bottom up, meaning from taking it from the experiences, but also in terms of a step by step process. Linkage is internal displacement, cross-border displacement. What we have seen is very often it's in the first step internal displacement. It becomes cross-border if there is no protection or not sufficient protection and assistance available in country, then people simply out of desperation have to move to a neighboring country. The second situation is where the disaster occurs in a border area, and some of the people cross borders, some remain simply because of escape routes. You have a river you cannot cross, so you have to cross the border instead. And those on the other side of the river inside the country, they cannot escape to the neighboring country simply for reasons like that, geographical reasons. The third situation is not we have internal displacement, and then secondary movement, but that are more of a voluntary nature. Mm-hmm. People see recovery activities are insufficient, or it will take years to rebuild. I don't really have good chances here, so maybe it's better to look for economic opportunities abroad, for instance, in the aftermath of the earthquake in Christchurch in New Zealand. We saw the number of people from that area increasing. An increased number of people from that area moved to Australia. Simply, if you're a guy like me, a lawyer, and not an engineer or a construction worker, no jobs left in such a situation. These are kind of the interlinkages, but there are certainly more, and we are still exploring and learning more about that.
Claude, would you like to respond?
Thank you. You used, thank you, madam, for the question. You're right, the conflict-induced displaced people are more on the radar. And there are frameworks for protection and agencies that take care of it. The disaster-induced displaced people lack this framework. That's why we try to shape a framework. And it doesn't have to be legal. It can be smart diplomatic engineering, and I believe in that, as long as it yields a result that can be quickly implemented. That's what, as a responsible for human rights in Swiss diplomacy, what I'm interested in. So we have to build a coalition of the willings, that's the thing we make, to put an issue on the agenda and then slowly mainstreaming. It happened with the green economy, with ecology. 40 years ago, it was seen as an obstacle to business, and today you make money with green technology. So it's about time that human rights processes are also mainstream, because without proper protection, you cannot have human security, you cannot have development. You used the word intervention. Could you specify why you said intervention? Because we see that we are not shaping something that intervenes into sovereignty. We are offering a tool for countries that might receive this population and are in duty to respond for, at least morally, for humanitarian help, or some the same countries could have their own citizens being in this situation. So we are offering a tool, and there is no intervention into sovereignty.
The reason I mentioned the word intervention is because even as a researcher,
when you are investigating conflict-induced displacement, you are regarded as an outsider. Because internal displacement being a sovereign issue, a national issue, even the outside researcher is regarded as some interloper. For example, I was researching the conflict in Kashmir. And even to interview the government officials, I was regarded as an interventionist into their national framework. So that's why I'm thinking natural disasters also being a national issue, how is your approach going to be taken by the state governments?
And thank you. That is the reason. No, but the regional seminar have shown that most countries are at loss. They are crying for some kind of a framework. So I don't feel that this would be a big obstacle, but I might be wrong.
Yeah, I can build up on what Ambassador Wild said. Conflict, of course, is always eminently political. Of course, politics is everywhere, but natural disasters are not perceived as primarily political. This helps. That's the first thing. The second issue is that with the Nansen Initiative, you're talking about cross-border movements, so it's already internationalized. Country receiving people from their neighboring countries or people from the region, and then saying, well, unless we get international support, then we are not really able to respond. So again, it's internationalized. In the context of climate change, particularly countries in the south, then also look at the responsibilities of the north, at questions of, and this is being discussed, under loss and damage in the climate change negotiations of who has to pay for that impact. And again, from the beginning on, it's an international kind of issue. It's internationalized. And this is really different from internal conflict. And I know what you're talking about, having been dealing with conflict-induced internal displacement. Here, I don't see the kind of reactions I got when I was in my previous mandate.
Would someone like to respond to the question on women?
Well, maybe we both can. All right. So thank you very much for the question. I think I haven't done specific research on the rights of women in this context, but from the work I've been involved in, certainly what has become very apparent is that if we are consulting with communities about what it is that they want and what strategies they'd like implemented, it's important, in fact it's fundamental, that you identify the appropriate people who are considered leaders at a range of different levels within that community. And that can be pretty tricky, and often, not always, but often it can be tricky to work out among women who is it that we should be speaking to about the issues that are of particular concern to them. One thing that has come up through the refugee context more broadly is that often when people move, they find themselves in very different gender roles from what they've been in previously. And just one example from Kiribati, this was not about movement per se, but I was interviewing a woman who was about 88, and in the middle of this conversation she said, oh, of course, the problem was when they told us about CEDAW. And I went, sorry, what? And that's the convention, the women's convention, essentially. And she said, oh, we had people in here who told us about our rights as women. So we went home and our husbands didn't like what we were saying, and apparently domestic violence rates kind of spiked. Now, that's not to say you don't inform people about what rights they have. Certainly that's not what I'm trying to do. But what it does show is the importance of making sure that any interventions are culturally specific and are supportive rather than kind of maladaptive, even when they are incredibly well-intentioned. Chiloka probably has more to say than
I do. One of the reports that I prepared for the General Assembly a few years ago was on IDP women specifically. And some of that did relate to the whole issue of the way in which IDP women respond to displacement and the role that they play in the context of displacement. And also in looking at the report on climate change and the mega trends that are related to slow onset disasters in the context of urban informal settlements. But I think, as the point was made by Wout and Jen, there are pre-existing vulnerabilities which relate to women, and very often disasters tend to exacerbate and multiply those vulnerabilities, and it then becomes important to look at what special measures of protection are required in the context of women. Take Haiti, for example. More IDP women are actually at risk of being trafficked out of Haiti because of the lack of an effective protection system for IDP women, but also the attempt to move out of Haiti to go somewhere else in search of safety and security and better livelihood. So vulnerabilities building around protection in that context. The second aspect you find is that IDP women are actually a resource for their families in situations of displacement, including disasters, because the issue of livelihoods, access to food and water, that responsibility very often falls upon women. The women are more resilient. The men become disorientated fairly quickly. You know, they lose the balance of where they actually are. Their sense of authority is eroded, but women keep their focus. They have to get food, they've got to get water for their children. Now, that means that if there isn't immediate access to water and food in their search for those resources, they also become more vulnerable and at risk of attack from others. In fact, it is always the case that they protect their men by saying, don't come with me, because if you come with me, there's a risk that you'll be attacked, but I'll take the risk. They calculate, you know, the risks, is saddened as bad it is, that they think it may be best for them to be sexually assaulted than to lose their husband or son in those contexts. So they take the calculated risk to protect their families in the context of livelihoods. I think there's also a further issue, especially in relation to slow onset disasters, that because women are the most vulnerable, not only will they be the most disproportionately affected categories, but they may also be the last individuals to try and move from the areas where they are. It's not uncommon for men to leave their families and move away and find other lives in informal settlements, but the women will remain with their children and family and will move as a matter of last resort. And therefore, it's important, again, to build effective response measures around those kinds of vulnerabilities. And I'll just add one or two things. In the context of IDPs and cross-border movements, obviously, internal movement will precede cross-border movements. But one of the factors that influences that, especially where you have common and porous borders in places like Africa, is also common identity across the border, where you do have groups of the same ethnicity or identity who are fleeing a disaster in their own country. Very often their choice of where to go will be influenced by whether or not there is ethnic identity across. So most of the Somalis will come to Kenya because in northern Kenya, you also have Somalis. Somalis that have an Ethiopian identity will go up into Somalia and not come down south, you know, for obvious reasons. So I think that those dynamics also shape our choices. In terms of a legal regime, I agree entirely with both Wouter and Jen. And I think here there are probably two small things to add. As Wouter indicated, you don't have numbers in terms of cross-border movements. But there's also, I think, a conscious denial of the fact that this is a social category that should be recognized and therefore should be protected, because very often legal concepts follow recognition of social concepts. A concept is recognized socially and with its effects before the law turns round. To actually recognize that in legal terms this is necessary, you know, to include legally. And here, internationally, of course, you have different dynamics in the sense of others who may not want to receive populations who are at risk or who are being relocated. But I think there are huge opportunities at regional levels in terms of the recognition of the problem and the dynamics of that. And I think that the problems are like the legal frameworks or policies are likely to arise from regional, national initiatives. There may also have to be bilateral arrangements, you know, between states. And I think this is an important aspect to actually try and promote, because of the fact that, as I indicated during our discussions at lunch, those persons who are displaced by natural disasters across boundaries are still formally under the responsibility of the state of origin, legally speaking. And that engages the responsibility of the state of origin and the receiving state to make adequate arrangements and measures regarding the treatment of these individuals. But I'd also like to see a link. It is unlikely to happen in practice, but in terms of intellectual thinking and advocacy, the Cancun agreements having recognized climate change-induced displacement, I would like to see a link between that category and common but differentiated responsibilities under the climate change framework, so that those responsibilities actually become a basis for dealing with cross-border movements on a differentiated but also on a common basis, and to try and move that regime a little bit forward within an integrated approach. I think those are
thanks. I think we'll take one final question from Anita in the back. And if you could introduce yourself.
You just did. Hi, Anita Mengetti, U.S. Department of State. My question is actually to anyone that wants to answer in the next 2 minutes, I guess. But that is, obviously, what we're talking about is the response or the thing that happens in the lurch when everything else has failed and people have to move. And that I would say at the core, this is a developmental issue and how we address development. And to that end, I'm wondering if any of you have done any thinking or are looking for ways for input into the post-2015 development agenda and some fitting this issue under some of the categories or some possible indicators to measure progress on this. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know. Tiloka, do you want to respond to that, or Walter?
I would be first.
Okay. I had some discussions on this issue last week in New York. Of course, if you're looking at the potential magnitude of the problem, the developmental impact, it should be part of the sustainable development goals. The challenge is how to get it into that long, long list we have. 19 focus areas, and I think 240 targets and goals. Now negotiators are in the process of reducing that to 5 targets and goals per focus area. Some focus areas will go. So we will have to be very clever and join hands to really get it in. But for me, it's clear that it is of a magnitude for the years and the decades to come that we can simply cannot afford it, not to mention it.
I agree. We had an annual meeting of special procedures and the conference organized by Austria in June last year to commemorate the Vienna Declaration and Program of Action. And as part of that process, we also began to look at how we could influence the post-2015 development agenda. And I think the initial approach was to clearly indicate categories that were of concern. Now, that seems to have generated a somewhat negative reaction, that those who are involved do not actually want to see a category-by-category approach of vulnerability and also of sustainable development. So in some of the informal discussions that I had in New York, there seems to be some consensus, at least, for an approach which is based on durable solutions on a sustainable basis. And I don't use the term durable solutions in the orthodox sense that it is used in relation to IDPs or refugees. I see the initiatives that are pursued by the Nansen envoy as promoting new durable solutions for people who are caught up in disasters and trying to move across boundaries and borders and receiving protection on that basis, so that our thinking about durable solutions, I think, has to be a little bit more imaginative and trying to include the language on durable solutions linked to development and sustainability might also be one way of approaching the subject.
Okay, well, I want to thank my distinguished panel and thanks to all of you for coming this afternoon, and look forward to seeing you again.